and welcome to the 13th episode of Mobile Podcast. Mobile Podcast gives you exclusive insights into the major public interest issues affecting the mobile telecommunications industry. I'm your host, Simon Clark, and in this edition we speak with the Executive Director of the Australian Centre for Radio Frequency Bioeffects Research, Professor Rodney Croft, about the ACRBR's research on the possible health effects of human exposure to electromagnetic fields. The Australian Centre for Radio Frequency Bioeffects Research is Australia's premier independent research facility dedicated to building a better understanding of the biological and possible health effects of electromagnetic fields. ACRBR opened in January 2004 and received $2.5 million in funding from the Australian Government for its research activities. The centre implements a multidisciplinary research program covering topics from RF effects on brain function through to epidemiological studies as well as dosimetry testing. ACRBR is also a source of public information on mobile phone health issues, staging public conferences and releasing position statements and fact sheets on important scientific topics. Mobile Podcast is honoured to have Professor Rodney Croft as our guest. Professor Croft and the ACRBR have received funds from the GSMA and MMF to conduct research projects. I spoke earlier with Rodney by phone from his office in Wollongong in Australia. Rodney, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
That's a pleasure, and let's start with the fact that ACRBR has received a lot of interest recently, most notably because of Professor Bruce Armstrong's comments about the Interphone study at your Science and Wireless Conference held last November. You joined Professor Armstrong on a discussion panel at that conference. Can you explain the interest there's been in his comments?
Yes, certainly. Well, as you know, it has taken a very long time for the pooled interphone results to be published, and they aren't published yet. And at our Science and Wireless event last year, we were fortunate to have Professor Armstrong provide a kind of meta-analysis of the cancer mobile phone epidemiology research that has been conducted to date, and that included some yet-to-be-published data from his group here in Australia. Now, in essence, this gave a sneak preview of the likely interphone results, but with the addition of some other research outside the interphone study protocol itself. Now, what he reported was that the extra data didn't change things considerably, with the main analysis failing to find any cancer-inducing or promoting effect on mobile phones, or of mobile phones, I should say, but leaving open the possibility that those who reported using a phone on the same side as their tumour and who reported using a phone for greater than 10 years may have an increased rate of acoustic neuroma. Now, of course, this is consistent with previous reports, which may be limited due to the small sample size of such analyses, as well as the possibility of reporting bias. So I guess where his presentation raised particular interest is that he said that he did not believe that these confounds were large enough to explain this reported increase and concluded that we should be cautious about mobile phones as a result. Now, personally, I don't find these limitations, well, I guess I should say I don't find the research relating to these limitations to be strong enough for us to conclude this. I think that the issue of the limitations is crucial for this debate. But certainly his view was that that we did understand the limitations well enough to be concerned about this, and certainly he is an eminent epidemiologist, and the public here in Australia have taken his views quite seriously.
Just to clarify then for a layperson's understanding of this issue, as you referred, Professor Armstrong said that he supports a precautionary approach or a cautious approach. Do you think then that there is enough evidence to support a precautionary approach at this stage?
No, I really don't. I think that what's needed is probably a better understanding of these confounds. At the moment, I think the confounds such as trying to work out whether people do report accurately which side of the head they use their phone on, or have used the phone on, I should say. I think things like that are crucial to this debate, and unless we understand them in much greater detail, I think we really just are left at the point where we can say at present there's no literature suggesting that there is an effect.
Now, of course, there were other speakers at the conference and other topics covered. Can you give us a summary of the proceedings at the Science and Wireless Conference?
Well, the focus of the evening was squarely on cancer epidemiology with Professor Armstrong, our keynote speaker, but we did also cover some other issues. Now, these range from the more lighthearted, where we tested the YouTube video where popcorn was apparently cooked by a few mobile phones, to some exposure assessment work that looked at levels around the home, as well as in the community more generally. In terms of the popcorn experiment, as expected, the tiny amount of energy that the phones were emitting wasn't enough to cook the popcorn. In fact, we had about 20 phones operating for considerably longer than the YouTube video, but we didn't have any luck. But we did have lots of other food on board, so it wasn't such an issue for us.
Your own piece of myth-busting.
That's right. This certainly may appear trivial, and, you know, in some respects it is, but as such fears are often involved in the mobile phone health debate, I do think it's pretty important for people to see things like this for themselves. There is a real debate out there, and I think that needs to be looked at seriously, but certainly having these kind of myths around doesn't help anyone. Now, in terms of the exposure assessment, this was really an opportunity to report on some recent research here in Australia by ARPANSA, that's the Australian Radiation Protection and Nuclear Science Agency, and the ACRBR itself, where RF exposure levels in 20 homes and around 8 base stations were tested to ensure that the standards set down by government were indeed being adhered to. As it turned out, RF exposures around the home were indeed very low, with the highest being around 4% of the appropriate limits. This happened to be immediately outside a microwave oven in one of the homes, but everything else was considerably lower than that. And the base station exposures likewise were very low, with the highest exposures measured being around about 1% of exposure standards. So all in all, what was being reported at Science and Wireless was that, at least in the homes and base station locations assessed, the exposures being measured were very low indeed. And if anyone's interested in following this up, we have quite a few details, including the presentations themselves, on our website at www.acrbr.org.au.
Terrific. Now, just moving away from Science and Wireless, recently the ACRBR published a review of epidemiological research on mobile phone use and brain tumours. Could you explain what this involved and what sorts of conclusions were drawn?
Certainly. Well, one of the difficulties that we felt was inherent in the mobile phone brain tumour epidemiology literature was the issue of pulling it all together into some sort of meaningful whole. For example, some colleagues had published meta-analyses that had to omit important data because it didn't fit easily into the type of analysis that was being conducted, and others had published reviews that ignored papers without providing good reasons. What we were trying to do here was to consider all of the data and see where it led us. Now, the overall conclusions were very clear, which is that when we consider the literature as a whole, there is no evidence of an association between mobile phone use and either acoustic neuroma, meningioma, glioma, or the combination of different brain tumours. This wasn't affected by the side of the head that the mobile phone was used on, nor by the amount of calls or duration since the tumour patient started using a phone. However, what was less clear was whether a small subset of the data, that pertaining to patients that reported using a mobile phone for more than 10 years on the same side of the head as the tumour, where there was some suggestion of an increase in tumour rate. However, as you may be aware, that there are a number of methodological difficulties with such research, and where our analysis led us was to the conclusion that these methodological issues are really too great for us to treat these reports of increases as more than suggestive, and that more research will be required before we can determine whether there is such an effect. So, although it would be nice to have a definitive answer one way or the other at the moment, the conclusion was really that there is currently no evidence of an association, and that we'll have to wait some decisive research to determine the issue.
Okay, and moving to another study from by the ACRBR, that was on exposure levels from radio frequency devices in the average sort of a home. Can you tell us what devices you tested and what you found?
Sure. Well, this study was really a chance to check whether the levels of electromagnetic emissions that we believe are resulting from a number of different devices in the home are in fact accurate. For instance, there has been questions from the public regarding the possibility that emissions from multiple devices might accumulate and exceed ICNIRP and correspondingly Australian emission standards. And although this doesn't necessarily make sense theoretically, we just wanted to confirm it empirically. And so what we did was we tested 20 suburban homes in Melbourne here in Australia. These homes all reported having a number of RF devices. We tried to get people that were quite into their RF devices so we could get a sort of worst-case scenario. And we went in and measured the RF levels, so we should say we got NATA-accredited technicians to go and do the measurements for us. Now, these included everything from microwave ovens, wireless broadband and Wi-Fi to, well, baby monitors. Overall, what we found was the levels were indeed quite low, and the highest output from any of these homes was that of a microwave oven in one of the homes, where it was recorded at still only about 4% of the general public exposure limit, but the majority were less than about 1%. We also checked whether having multiple devices operating at the same time made any difference, and essentially it didn't make any difference. It turned out that there was virtually no additive effect at all. So the data was certainly in keeping with expectations, with nothing emitting levels anywhere near the ICNIRP standards.
Now, there's another topic receiving a lot of interest at the moment, and that's the bioinitiative report, and ACRBR published a review of that report in December. Can you give us a brief summary of your conclusions and findings there?
Yes. Well, there certainly has been a lot of discussion in the media about the bioinitiative report, and it was really because of that that the ACRBR thought it important to provide a statement that reflected our more scientific backgrounds and perspectives on the document. I guess in terms of an overall picture of where we got to with that, we essentially argued in this report that the bioinitiative report does not progress science, and I guess would agree with the Health Council of the Netherlands that the bioinitiative report, and I quote, is not an objective and balanced reflection of the current state of scientific knowledge. So for us, as it stands, it's really more providing a set of views, this report, views that aren't consistent with the consensus of science, and really there was nothing in it to take us any further. I guess we're saying that it wasn't rigorous enough to really raise any doubts about what is a pretty solid scientific consensus at the moment. In terms of specifics, I guess I'd say that the main issues for us were really that this didn't represent any kind of independent consensus document. In particular, it didn't try to evaluate the science, but as was stated in the bioinitiative report itself, it was really written to document the reasons why current public exposure standards just aren't good enough for public health. So it's really a thesis pushing a particular view rather than a group of scientists trying to get together and evaluate what's going on. There's also another issue for us, which is really that it hasn't undergone the normal scientific process of peer review. And again, as it hasn't gone through this process, it really has to be viewed more as a series of personal perspectives of the authors rather than a genuine part of science. I should point out that I do not think that the peer review process is devoid of flaws. There's certainly a lot of issues to do with that, but I do think that it does offer at least some checks and balances that help to ensure scientific rigor. So coupled with that, I guess the last issue that we raise in our commentary on it is that at present we do have very strong consensus views in the area. We do have organisations like the World Health Organization / ICNIRP, for instance, that have reviewed the literature very thoroughly. And the Bioinitiative report is certainly in stark contrast to the kind of conclusions that come out of these groups. And yet there is nothing really in the Bioinitiative report which gives us a reason for not believing these reports from, for instance, World Health Organization. And I think really something is needed in there to show why there might be a problem with the standard scientific perspective. And for us, that just isn't there. And without that, we, I guess, came away feeling that we needed something much stronger than the Bioinitiative report before we could really be convinced that there was any problem, and that we just don't have.
And yet there's quite a lot of concern in Europe, for example, about this Bioinitiative report, and particularly so amongst ministers in the European Parliament. What's your take on that?
Well, I guess it shows a divide, if you like, between science and policy. Certainly, when we talk of science, we are talking about the kind of organisations and reviews of the literature that that come from World Health Organization, ICNIRP, and we really don't see any ambiguity there. People do agree the standard scientific perspective is quite unanimous, that at the moment we don't have any reason to be concerned. And so if we look at the science, we really have one perspective, but on the other hand, we've got people that are being people that are making decisions and basing it on such instruments as the Bioinitiative report. And all I can see is that what this says is that the decisions aren't based on science, that the decisions are based more on, I guess, concerns by the community, views such as are espoused in the Bioinitiative report being pushed quite strongly. But it certainly doesn't change my mind about the science.
If I could ask you also about your view of the perception of risk, in that sometimes policymakers might respond to views ordinary people have of risk, which doesn't bear a lot of relation to scientific evidence on the actual degree of risk.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, politicians aren't in a position to understand the science in the same way that scientists do, and there's always going to be a few steps in between scientists and the policymakers. And certainly it would be normal for policymakers to jump to conclusions that aren't as well founded as they might like to think. That's the nature of the beast, I think. But I guess for me, the focus certainly has to be on the science, and where I have to look for in making determinations and recommendations, well, it really has to come down to groups like the World Health Organization.
Well, moving back to something more clearly focused on the science, you led the largest study to date on the impact mobile phones can have on brainwave activity. Can you explain how you did this study and your results?
Yes, well, this was a study that really built on previous human neurophysiology research from our lab, and it was designed to explore what we've argued are mobile phone-related bioeffects in much more detail, I guess. Now, this really relates to reports of changes to a naturally occurring rhythm of the brain, roughly in the 8 to 15 hertz range. This really just means that there's some activity in the brain that fluctuates about 8 to 15 times a second. And what we were keen to see is whether or not this effect differed between second generation and third generation phones, and also to see whether this changed as a function of age. Now, unfortunately, I'm not actually in a position to disclose the results, as we've got two papers describing the results currently under review, and really we just have to leave it until they're actually published before I can tell you the results. But it certainly is going to help answer the question that a lot of people have been asking about whether things really differ for children. There has been concern about whether there are any differences in children. The majority of the research is looking at adults. And the question is, are the results from adults really generalizable to kids? Have we got anything more serious to worry about with kids?
Thank you for telling us about that. Not that there's a lot that we can conclude, but we'll watch out for that. And finally, can I ask you about some of the projects you're working on at the moment and what we might see from ACRBR in the future? I mean, for example, is there going to be another Science and Wireless this year?
Yes, well, certainly there will be a Science and Wireless for 2009. So if anyone's thinking of taking a holiday in Australia in October, please do come and join us. We will have the information on our website, should be up in June about the specifics of that, but that's all in the planning phase at the moment. In terms of other ACRBR projects, we are drawing to the conclusion of our first teenage cohort study, which is led by Professor Michael Abramson from Monash University. What this is it's a study where we've been following 13-year-olds and assessing general health and cognitive functions and seeing whether there's any relationship between these measures and their reported mobile phone use. I'd say they're really the, some of the most exciting things that are coming out at the moment, but unfortunately we'll have to hold our breath on those as well.
Well, there's some very interesting work and some interesting results to look forward to. So we will do that. And can I say now, Rodney, thank you so much for joining us on the program. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
You're very welcome.
Mobile Podcast would like to thank Professor Rodney Croft for taking his time to appear on the program. We'd also like to thank you for listening and hope you enjoyed the 13th episode produced in April 2009. Mobile Podcast will be available for download regularly at www.mmfai.org/mobile podcast or www.gsmworld.com/health. Mobile Podcast is made available for download by the Mobile Manufacturers Forum and the GSM Association. The information contained on this podcast is provided for general information purposes only and does not purport to offer legal, health or any other professional advice. Where reference is made to a company or a specific commercial product or service, howsoever referred, no endorsement or recommendation is implied or intended. The views expressed are those of the speakers alone and do not necessarily represent those of the Mobile Manufacturers Forum or GSM Association. All guests have volunteered their time to help promote an open discussion of the issues addressed.